if man is still alive. If woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do and say is in the pill you took today. Nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 55, your arms are hanging limp at your side.
Are we ready?
Your legs got nothing to do.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Welcome to Stocks and Jocks. Take it away, Chief.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tomorrow Jimmy on the board. S&P futures down 2. Yeah, 2. NASDAQ futures down 18. Dow futures down 19. Not much going on there. We got oil down $1.11. So it's back to the 64.31. Still a little higher than it has been, but not going crazy. It was up to 64, but and we've got gold down $39, silver down $3. So do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning, sir. Do you remember how long that song was on the top of the charts?
A long time.
Forever. Yep. I was working as a ball boy down at the Viking training camp, and that thing was on. That thing was played like every 15 minutes.
Yeah,
it's kind of. And it's disappeared. I mean, I don't know whether the rights to the song have not been released or whatever. But you know, it was a monster hit, and I was talking to somebody, one of the other young associate attorneys and at our firm, and I mentioned it, and they said I've never heard of it, and I said, well, it was on the top of the, it was like for months and months and months, and yet you don't hear it on Sirius. I've never heard it on Sirius streaming. I've never heard it on Spotify. So thanks, Jimmy, for putting that on, man.
Well, do you ever wonder boy, talking about wacky changing the subject. When you get to YouTube, you ever somehow or another, I stumbled in. There's this guy, who's a, he's kind of a historian. Well, I guess he is a historian. And he's trying to redate all the stuff in Egypt. Have you heard of this guy?
This is the guy we talked about last week with the.
Many weeks before, but.
The crust, with the Earth's crust disconnecting from the mantle.
Yeah, but the stuff in Egypt, and evidently, the story has been, you know, when the pyramids were built and all this crap, and the guy says that's all wrong, that the Great Pyramid is actually like 7,000 years ago, and it's the idea that the Egyptians could have built it is totally crazed, according to him, because there's a couple reasons. One is the millions and millions of blocks that are in the thing. At the rate anybody says these guys could build stuff, there's no way they could have, right? So, okay, that's one of the issues. But the big issue is the base. and he talks about the thing is within, like, you know, half a centimeter of exactly where it's supposed to be. But the big deal is that there's been no deflection. There's been no sinking. He said, even if you could figure out how to get the blocks there and you know, get them up the thing, and there's like 1.5 million blocks in the thing, he says, there's no way anybody could prepare the base for that kind of weight. He says, we can't do that today, where there wouldn't be 1 inch of sinking on one side or the other. Anyway, his point comes that this was built like 7,000 years ago by somebody. And you start to get different people that are you know, talking about things that happened way, way, way back. Question is, what happened to all these people? I mean, if there really were people here 7,000 years ago that were that advanced, what happened to them? Did they kill themselves, or did something kill them, or what?
Well, the same thing happened to them that happened to the Romans. You know, when Rome fell, the scientists and the engineers that designed the aqueducts and the roads and the concrete and all the fantastic structures that we marvel at, they died off. And within, 100 years, it was impossible for the remaining civilizations in Europe to replicate what the Romans had built. And I think we consistently, I said there's an element in our psyche that consistently underestimates the capabilities of ancient peoples. And this gets brought home to me every time I visit Europe, and do you think of the Roman Empire every day? Because I do. Remember that meme that was going around on Twitter?
I do a little more than most, because I stuck taking 4 years of Latin, so.
Yeah, well, I think about, because I'm fascinated with Roman history, when I'm in Europe, we try to swing by and look at or take trips to places where the Romans have been working and have done stuff. And it's fascinating to me. And as I said, this was also brought home on, I was in England in the fall for I was in England for the Broncos game. And I went out to Stonehenge. And have you ever been there?
No, but you were telling me it was, shall we say, redone at some point, wasn't it?
Well, it was rebuilt. They rebuilt it in like 1920. It had actually been it was privately owned. And this British citizen bid on it and bought it. And, nobody, again, when you're working hard at surviving and trying to get through the Industrial Revolution in England, you don't really ponder, because there's history everywhere, you don't really ponder, this big field of these giant rocks sitting out there. And so this guy bought it and then donated it to the British government, and they got archaeologists in there who figured out what it was and put it back together. I mean the original site, the stuff had tipped over, but the location of the stones was easily determined.
That's a perfect example, is if you don't, what this guy's talking about, that the base is so important, and people didn't know how to do the base.
Well, again, Stonehenge is dated. The site is dated from somewhere around, maybe as early as 15,000 years ago.
That's unbelievable, yeah.
Maybe 20,000 years ago, 15,000 BC. And it was a burial site, at least at some point. And then somebody or some group decided, we are going to build a celestial memorial here. And we're going to tie it because again, we underestimate what these guys were doing. These were not, you're talking about effectively people who were as smart as modern man, but an element of them that, they didn't have TV and they didn't have streaming and they didn't have, what was it, Hager and Evans playing music like in the year 2025. So what they did was they looked at the sky and they looked at nature and they observed patterns, because that's part of the way we've been engineered by our environment. And so they tracked stuff, and they created their separate worlds in their imagination of how this was all supposed to work. But they also figured out, hey, we want to do this, and we see the sun coming up in the same place at the same time every year, and we understand, we have a way of measuring. We may not be able to measure time down to the millisecond, but we know that days are getting longer after this certain point, because we can track the shadows of the sun. And so these guys figured out, they figured out a rough astrological calendar. They figured out where the sun and the moon were likely to be at certain times. They set these gigantic stones that they took from, as far as we can tell, several hundred miles away, and for some reason decided these were the things we wanted to put in place. They quarried them, they transported them.
Somehow
without a wheel, and so they got all this stuff together, and they constructed.
You would think if they could do all that, they could invent a wheel.
But it didn't occur to them.
I know. Yeah, it didn't.
You know, and so they had other ways of solving the problems, and the way, I mean, if you talk to the docents at Stonehenge, the way they did it was with good old fashioned manual labor, you know, and people pulling sledges, and to the extent that they had animals that they had domesticated, using those.
Well, but I'm not so mostly sure that they didn't have some help. I mean, the thing with the pyramid.
Oh, I know, Van Daniken, Eric Van Daniken, but you know, Van Daniken's whole theory, if you read Chariots of the Gods back in the 1970s, yeah, and I did, because a bunch of my high school classmates got hot on it. Van Daniken's theory, you know, was that it was physically impossible. So for example, Easter Island, that's my favorite, where he said it was physically impossible for Easter Island to grow enough food or have enough agriculture in place to sustain a human population that could move those heads and pick them up and move them around, because it would require hundreds of people. So there's a story you can find it online of this guy who goes back out there because he's following Van Daniken's footsteps, and he's basically retracing what he did and the research that he did. And he goes out to Easter Island, he's looking at this giant stone head, and these two guys, you know, come up to him and go, "Yeah, it's pretty impressive." And he said, "You know, I wonder how it got up there." And they said, "Oh, we can move it for you." And he said, "What?" So, you know, they got three or four guys, and they pick the thing up and you know, carry it up the hill. And so this guy's going, "Wait a minute, if this is not true, if such a basic fundamental thing of not figuring out that three or four guys could pick one of these things up and move it is not part of Van Daniken's
factors." Well, some of the drawings that show essentially the Earth being round and see parts of the world that they didn't even see are pretty impressive.
I'm less concerned about that because even the Greeks with their, you know, knowledge and their powers of observation, even they knew the Earth was round. Yeah. And one of their mathematicians calculated the circumference of the Earth or the diameter of the Earth to within like 2 or 3%. So that's pretty good. I'm not worried about that. What surprises me is, and I don't think you have a really good explanation for it, is some of the stuff you see in South America where you have these gigantic figures sketched into the desert. And they're only visible from thousands of feet in the air. And they only make sense as a picture from thousands of feet in the air. And so you're asking yourself, why were they doing this?
Well, either were doing it because they felt or had a religion or something that somebody was coming and they needed a spot. They needed a landing field.
I mean that's one theory, but you know, the perspective of from thousands of feet up, how did that occur to people who couldn't get more than 2 or 3 feet off the ground? You know, were they looking? I mean, it wasn't like there was a mountain range right there,
a giant cliff
for them to look down on.
Everybody has some sort of deity, and the deity was always up, so the deity come to see you is coming down. And I mean, this is just off the top of my head, but you know, you don't have to go back that far, Lou, for your theory. If you would have stripped the computers off everybody's desk, I mean, for those that I always drop back into railroads, there really were only four passes in this country that you could get from west to east. I mean, the original Transcontinental Railroad uses the Moffett Pass, where the people ate each other. Not Moffett, but that was
the Donner.
Yeah, the Donner Pass.
Where those people got stranded.
Yeah, and ate each other.
In that blizzard recently.
Yeah. And then there's one up north where the Northern Pacific and the Great Northern went through. And there's two in the south, one where the Southern Pacific goes and the other one where the Santa Fe goes. There really aren't any other. Well, then there became a fifth. They said, look, to go from Denver, you had to go north or south to go west, right, back in the day. So they said, oh, we're going to build a railroad tunnel through the Continental Divide. Okay, they had a lot of tunnels in Sierra Nevada and so forth, but through the Continental Divide was one hell of a tunnel. So they give these guys the scheme, and it's probably the 20s maybe. They started on both sides, Lou, and the thing is what? A mile or two long, at least. And when they got to the middle, they were what, a quarter inch off or a half inch off? Without even, no computers, no satellites, no nothing. I don't think anybody does that today. Without the, you could with a computer probably, but
let me give you another example. Again, back to our buddies the Romans, and I may have mentioned this before. I when I was in southern France, my wife ran off to a wine tasting. I went off to look at this aqueduct, Gare du something or other, and I've dumped the name of it. Anyway, it's this huge aqueduct. It's a UNESCO site. And the Romans had built an aqueduct bringing fresh water from a stream to this town that they had built. And Roman houses, upscale Roman houses, all had running water. I don't know if you know that.
Yep, I knew. I didn't know. Were they all tied into the aqueduct somehow?
They were tied into this aqueduct. Do you take a guess at how long? So this aqueduct's this lead pipe. They ran this pipe from this spring to this town.
That's what killed them, the lead.
Well, if what killed them mainly wasn't coming out of the pipes, because lead doesn't dissolve in water. But if you heat your, if you cook with lead pots, you will release the lead into the water. Anyway, the lead pipe ran. Guess how long, or the distance that the lead pipe ran?
It's got to be miles and miles.
36 miles.
Whoa.
Now, this is 36 miles, and there's no pump. So they have to get the water. It's a gravity feed. And the drop over 36 miles was 15 yards.
That's unbelievable.
So they had to map a course for this pipe so that it was continually going downhill, in some cases by as little as 1 to 2 inches. In the course of hundreds of yards, I had to map a case for this pipe with no significant horizontal stretches, and God forbid, no uphill stretches, because it won't work.
Backs right up, yeah.
Yeah. So what they did was they set up this kind of a mechanism, looked like a sawhorse, with a pipe in it, a tube in it, that could with a some kind of a like a level that allowed them to see whether one end of the sawhorse was higher than the other. And it's the sawhorse is about 10 feet long, maybe 15 feet long, and they went over the course of 36 miles from this spring to this town, what, 10 to 15 feet at a time, tracking where they were going to lay this pipe. And it works. So the docent that was walking us through this process says, so, you know, one of the first things when the space shuttle went up is they did a radar map of the surface of the Earth with a resolution down to 3 inches. And that gave us the height of the surface of the planet, you know, in a very, very high resolution. And somebody at some point said, you know, we got this data. Let's just see where this pipe should have gone. And so they ran a computer simulation and said, find out if you were taking a pipe from this spring to this town, run us through, you know, run the route and give us the best route. Almost identical to what the Romans did.
Well, I mean, we see that, when I say recently, you look at the Transcontinental Railroad, that was essentially surveyed and mapped out by people on horseback dodging arrows. You know, and that's not just being funny, that's the truth.
No. Sure.
And when they built I-80, essentially goes the same place, right? At least for most of it. I-80 is never more than a half a mile away. And I think there was some satellite on that. But it's never more than a half a mile away, is it?
Right. Well, again, we underestimate the capability of ancient peoples. And the more I learn about what these Bronze Age guys or Iron Age guys or Stone Age guys were doing up in England and stacking rocks, huge rocks, stacking them for the hell of it, as far as we can tell. You know, it didn't serve any commercial purpose. There was some other motivation getting these people to do this. Now, whether it was the salvation of their souls or whatever, but the skill set to put those stones together, the skill set of the Greeks putting columns together in the Parthenon in Athens so perfectly, you know, stacking these giant marble blocks, first of all cutting them and then stacking them so perfectly, angling them up so perfectly that we couldn't fit them together any better with machines. The Romans, followed by the Romans, doing you know, these miracle engineering projects, huge engineering projects, harbors and roads that went for, you know, hundreds of miles. This, again, all done by people with, you know, without even slide rules. By the way, there's a great comedy scene, you can find it on YouTube, from a place called Utopia. It's sort of like an Australian TV show based on The Office, except it's a government. It's a government bureau, and these guys are, they bring in some old guy. He's retired. He's working under some government program to get seniors out of their homes and have them try to do something useful. So he happens. This government agency is a building agency, and they put projects together. So this guy is an old school engineer, as it turns out, and they assign him, they give him some giant monster project of railroad or something that they're trying to build, and he comes in and he's working on his figures with a pencil and paper, not with using a spreadsheet, and these people are sort of watching him through this conference room, and they see him doing this thing with this ruler, the slide rule, and somebody goes, "What is that?" And they're all going, "What?" And somebody goes, "They decided that it's the thing that measures your shoe size," because, you know, it's a sliding ruler. And they go, "Is he measuring shoe size? Why has he got that in there?" Anyway, classic line.
Did you ever learn how to use one of those things? One of my buddies, one of my roommates.
I was the last class at the Air Force Academy, Tom, that was issued a slide rule.
My roommate was a master at it.
Yeah, I was told I started to learn how to use it, and then I think like a month or two into my academic year, the first Texas Instruments calculator came out, and we all went down to the, as soon as we could get off base, we all went down to the local Radio Shack, and bought these basic TI calculators that could do things, you know, the slide rule. You could do the same thing on a slide rule. The slide rule could do some other stuff.
Who invented the slide rule? What kind of genius was that?
I don't know. I don't know where it was. I'm sure that's something we could figure out. But I also hearken back to Apollo 13. I took my kids to see Apollo 13 when it came out, and they were, I don't know, 13. My oldest was 13. My youngest was 11. And so we're watching the movie, and it was absolutely captivating for my oldest son. But in the middle of the movie, you know, as they're coming back to Earth, they're trying to calculate the reentry angles for the space capsule to make sure they don't burn up in the atmosphere, and they're using a slide rule, and he's calculating this. It shows him calculating this on the screen, and my kid grabs my arm and goes, "What is that?" And I said, "It's a slide rule. I'll explain it to you after the movie, but it's kind of like a calculator." And he's
but it does
riveted.
Way more than that. It does log normal. It does,
oh, yeah,
log
it does logs and a bunch of other stuff. He's riveted by this. So we get out of the movie, and he goes, "What is that?" So I pull out the one I've got. I think I've still got it in my Foot Locker, and I pulled it out and showed it to him. And I said, "So you know, just basic multiplication. You would put this line, or, you know, this number with this line corresponding to this number over another line that corresponds to another number, and then you'd look down the ruler and you'd see where the third line lines up, and that gives you your answer." And he said, "Okay, that's great, but what happens when you know that there's the lines aren't exact, and the third line is between two lines on the readout scale?" And I said, "Well, you would estimate, you'd interpolate where that line is and what those numbers should be." And he looked at me with this look. I've never seen, you ever see a 13-year-old with a look of horror on his face? And he goes, "You mean you guess?" And I said, "Listen, kid, this got us to the moon, okay? Don't make fun of me."
Well, that's the truth. I mean, what the mayhem... that we're seeing in all levels. What was the guy in Britain, the ambassador that was arrested for the Epstein stuff? What was he charged with? Do anybody know what the charges are?
I don't think he was arrested.
Yeah, he was.
Andrew. It was Andrew that was arrested.
No, the other guy was arrested too. They came and got him.
Well, Andrew was arrested for disclosing state secrets.
The other guy, the ambassador, was arrested as well. And I'm saying I've not heard a.
I knew he was, you know, a target.
They went and got him like on Monday morning or something. They didn't put cuffs on him, but they let him away.
I guess the Prince Andrew arrest sort of dominated the news that I was following coming out of the UK. I don't know. I mean, was he actually charged with procuring?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know what
the irony of that, of course, is that they've got thousands of apparently Central Asian men wandering around Britain right now who are involved in rape gangs that went on for years, that they have absolutely no doubt about their guilt or innocence. They're guilty. They've got eyewitness testimony on these guys, and they're wandering around. Nobody's doing anything. But they're happy to arrest their, you know, their senior British officials on kind of musty allegations or unclear allegations.
Well, if you're talking state secrets that you're giving to people so you can boink a 14-year-old, I think it's pretty serious.
Well, if they've got that, I mean, if he's doing that, fine. But again, the irony is right there. I don't know if you know how bad that situation was with the rape gangs in the UK.
I heard something about that the other day.
There's more coming out. There's more coming out every day, and it is. It's actually unbelievable, Tom.
Well, you can also whatever it is, whatever side of the political, and this is something I can't even with nothing. It has nothing to do with my youth or upbringing. The idea that if you don't like, I'm not saying they're not doing it. I mean, obviously not. But the idea that if there's blame someplace, you immediately turn to people you don't like and you find blame there or something, and it's...
Oh, no, this has been going on. This has been known for more than a decade.
Well, it can't be happening.
This is not new.
It can't be happening like murders or something. I mean...
It's very similar to that. And, they think there were some murders committed as these gangs shut up these 14-year-old and 15-year-old girls that they had been grooming and had been raped hundreds of times.
As these
girls aged out and started talking, there were some murders. But you ought to get in and just pull up a summary of the testimony that was well known to the British police, and they refused to investigate.
Why?
Pardon me?
Why?
Because they were afraid, and this is, again, hard to believe, they were afraid of being accused of racism because the perpetrators were exclusively Central Asian men.
When I say I have issues with that, I don't have issues with what you just said. I have issues with this. I think all this stuff, you know, whatever it is, and I see it in Chicago all the time. First of all, you don't see any police, but if you did... You know, the mantra would be, you see some guy with a you know, blacked out window flying down the expressway. I'm not going to pull him over because he's probably black, and oh, by the way, I'll get sued. This long dissertation of crap where you don't do your job, I think, Lou, at some level, is just an excuse for not doing your job.
I don't know about that, but the situation that happened in the UK and the situation that happened in the United States after Michael Brown is known as the Ferguson effect, and it's real, and it resulted in police refusing to enforce or go into certain neighborhoods to make arrests. It resulted in a huge spike in murders once the Black Lives Matter movement took hold after George Floyd. And it's a real thing.
I think it's absolutely is a real excuse. You know, I mean, there's no question. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm saying, but the point is, my view is, I'm not going to kidnap somebody and make him become a policeman. I mean, I can't imagine. You know, that job is really pretty hard, and I feel for these guys, but at some point, when you punch the clock. I mean, to go collect garbage is a smelly deal. Okay. And once you punch your clock, that's what you do. If you don't want to do, don't show up, but don't get paid and do nothing.
Well, I think the issue, and I mean, this is not a question of these guys saying, I'm afraid of going into these neighborhoods, although that may have been a function. It was mainly, I'm afraid of finding my life destroyed, like that cop that shot Michael Brown. I'm afraid of having my life destroyed. I'm afraid of having my kids ostracized.
I'm saying it's more of a, that needs to be dealt with to the point where the end of the day in some of these bad neighborhoods, somebody's daughter can't walk down the block. That cannot be allowed to happen, in my opinion. That cannot be. You can't get there. You can't go from people controlling the neighborhood and the people who are hired to make that not happen to protect regular people, them bailing out. Oh man, I'm gonna get sued. I'm gonna do this if I shoot the wrong person. Some element of training, some way. There has to be a way to deal with this. And not doing anything is not the answer, especially if you're getting paid.
I agree, but it's a real thing. So anyway.
Yeah, it is. Hopefully maybe this year again, but I play ball with a lot of cops, and once in a while you'll hear somebody say, "Oh man, I'm not gonna stop anybody. You need the okay from the sergeant to make a traffic stop." There's this big interwoven line of crap. That where you see somebody with a red light, you let them go. I don't care where the line of crap is. Your job is to pull a guy over, isn't it?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's what you're supposed to do. And you can intertwine all these. You know, Lou, I mean, we can find people that are ditch diggers and will find you every different way in the world to say they shouldn't be digging the ditch. Well, yeah, but you're a ditch digger. You're getting paid. I mean, I know it's harsh, but I had a guy when I first started. Hired a guy to be a trader. He was afraid to trade. I'm like, well, that doesn't do you much. The only trades the guy ever made is I walked in the pit and did the trade and said, you write it up. I mean, what's the point of that? If you're not, I know every time you open your mouth, you could make money, you could lose money, you could scratch, right? So
yeah.
it's like throwing a pass. You know, two out of three things are bad, right? Well, but that's what you do. That's what I'm paying you for. Right? I mean, what about a lawyer who's afraid to go to court? What good is he?
Yeah, well, yeah,
I might lose.
Not worth a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, so what's I was wishing you around the other day. We started talking a little bit about the college and this concept, and some of my Notre Dame buddies are, I don't know if they're you know, they're all pretty good dudes, real good dudes, but somehow they're locked into this. We can still become, we can still be somewhat of the old school and the new school combined. And they don't. I don't think they. I don't know. Maybe they're not been in business as long as I have. Once you're a professional, you know, once you're a crook, you're a crook. You know, you can't be half a gangster, nookie. This idea of in college ball. When do we get to the point where somebody cuts somebody halfway through the season because they're not doing well? One of these outside payers. I paid you to be the starting quarterback and not to be the backup. You're cut. I mean, who's writing these deals? I mean, who's in charge of these players? Is it the coaches? I mean, there's so much going on here that I would just love to get my arms around, and I think you probably know more of it. But how can you be half a professional? I mean, you look at the Olympics. Everybody's 35 years old, for God's sake. You know, they've been in five Olympics. I mean, it was fun to watch, but sure as hell is different than 30 years ago, isn't it?
This was a discussion that I had a couple of months ago. We were one of the things that my firm is getting pulled into is the college athlete issue with respect to potential compensation and Title IX issues. And these claims are moving rapidly, and the courts are doing a not very good job of trying to sort them out because there's no guidance, and it goes back to this whole issue of, are these people employees? Are they pros? Do we want to try to maintain this amateur status? My thought process has always been that the only countries that had amateur athletes were us and maybe Canada. Everybody else is getting paid, and getting paid across all
sports.
Well,
also, we're not affiliated with a school.
Right. Well, but I mean, in terms of the Olympics before we allowed pros in the late 80s and early 90s, the only people that were playing by the rules were us, and it hurt us. And I thought, oh, when they opened it up to professionals, I thought this is the way it ought to be, because there's no mechanism in international competition. There was no mechanism that was enforcing amateurism, or at least amateurism as we defined it. And it was sort of much like any other kind of international law. There was no enforcement. The only enforcement came by virtue of the people who either had money or, you know, like an international law force, had money to try to affect things, and we weren't playing that game. And so the 1980 Miracle on Ice hockey game was completely different than what we saw play out last weekend, because it was a team of basically college kids playing up against adult pros who had been playing together for years. And it was that way in basketball. It was that way in almost every team sport.
Well, the only thing in basketball is our college players were probably in those days the equivalent of.
They were.
Yeah.
They lost in Munich because the refs gamed them.
Without a doubt.
But you know the I remember watching that in real time and just going,
I did too.
What?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was.
Howard Cosell was all over the refs. Remember.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think.
Who did he interview afterward where he said, tell me, straight out, did the U.S. win this game? The answer was yes. Remember? What the hell was the interview?
Right.
I forget.
Because they put more time back on the clock.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't have any problems with clearing all that up because it was a pointless distinction.
It starts from I got a whole different view of this, Lou. Maybe because I went to Notre Dame and we had a real team and Arrow was there, and you got to go to a terrific game every week in the fall. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty neat. But I learned early on, this basking in the reflected glory only goes too far. I mean, to a certain extent, if I want to see our college kids, if they lose to, you know, the Croatian pro team. Lou, it doesn't matter to me or you or anybody. I mean, if they win, nothing grows an inch that you want to have grow an inch, right? I mean, it is what it is. It's a sport. It's a softball game. I hate losing, go have a beer, and I play again the next day. I mean, that's the whole nature of sport. I mean, I listened to Pat Quinn this morning on the way in talking about these are our Bears. Our Bears? There's no we in Bears. what are we talking about? They just raised their ticket prices 13.5%, which is... The ticket price increase is more than their friggin' lease. And some idiot wrote a lease that the lease doesn't go up with the ticket price increase. And now we're going to fall over themselves and do it again because they're not making enough money? I mean, what? Because they're our Bears. What do you mean our? They're not going to show up at my wake, are they? I doubt it. And there's some of this.
But, and yet, you cannot deny a very powerful feeling of pride when your team wins.
I have for a couple of hours, and it's an excuse to get together with people. I think it's a benefit. Other than that, I didn't make more money in 85.
It's a huge civic benefit, and there are a number of studies. Listen, there are a number of studies. If you you can look this one up. One of them had to do with the city of Pittsburgh, and as the Rust Belt movement swept through Pittsburgh and those steel mills shut down and people went out of work and the whole thing, the thing that kept people positive in Pittsburgh were the Pirates and the Steelers and to a certain extent the Penguins, and it allowed a civic identity to develop or to continue the one study I read said that they, you know, would have expected a suicide rate somewhere
there's a little bit of it.
This has been replicated over and over again.
It depends on who writes the story.
Well, no, it doesn't. It depends. It depends on whether you're paying attention. I watched this happen in real time in Minneapolis when they'd had a terrible football team. They had a lousy baseball team in the 1960s, and I watched what happened when you know the Minnesota Vikings coaching staff changed out, and within 3 years they were in a Super Bowl. And I watched that city rally, and it is palpable and it's tangible.
I understand that.
But if you're a politician,
but you can't.
You want to ride that wave.
You look at the state of Ohio. They have three major cities. The one that's outstripped all three. The other two has been Columbus, and they don't have a pro team. So you can't say that because of the Cincinnati Reds or the Browns in Cleveland. That all of a sudden the city is done terrifically well because they have a pro team. Columbus has outstripped the other two by far.
But it's the same. I'm not talking about a pro team. I'm talking about a sports team. And what happens in Columbus with Ohio State is exactly the same thing that happened in Cincinnati when they went to the Super Bowl.
I never once said that there wasn't some sort of civic pride. But what you're seeing
there's a huge amount.
Okay,
of
what you're seeing right now with the Bears. Okay, shows
so
you.
So for the listeners who aren't in Chicago, the Bears are threatening to take. Well, they're going to leave Chicago. They're going to go to Arlington Heights, which is an old racetrack site outside the city, which is fine. It's in the Chicago area. Or they're going to go to Indiana, which is not in Chicago, not in the Chicago area, and is not even in the same state as Illinois.
To say that, but now they have a stadium. If you built one today, would you build one like that? Probably not. But we're talking about a family. The city does not own any shares in the Bears. If they did, I'd feel a lot different about the whole thing. But they don't. The Bears, the family makes, I'm going to say, with the ticket price increase this year, I'm going to push them to $225, $250 million for as a family, not to mention all the people that work there and get paid. At some point, you got to go. Now, there's nothing wrong with Soldier Field. Plus, most of the money now is coming from TV, and TV works fine in Soldier Field. So the idea that somehow or another they need us to give them an 80,000-seat stadium where they can have naming rights and all those kinds of things, if they want to go do that, this is America, Lou. But you don't need a 20-year – name me anybody else is going to get a 20-year tax hold on a place being unimproved, which is mostly the only park – they're going to have an unimproved tax rate for 20 years? I mean, just let it be fair. I don't have any problem with it. Let it be fair. Or if the city is going to pony up, you know, $1 billion for a new stadium, guess what? They own 25% of the Bears. I mean, I wouldn't expect somebody to build PTI, a building, all on them, let us essentially stay there for free and not get a piece of PTI just because, you know, because somebody likes to watch football. I mean, there's a limit to this, is I guess what I'm saying.
I absolutely agree with you, and I say that as, you know, I say that as somebody who, you know, grew up in professional football. We'd love to say that this is just a sporting event. The short answer is, in some respects it is, but in very important respects it's a lot more, and. Part of that a lot more, and you as an economic guy should understand this directly. Part of that more is money, and that's why the colleges are falling all over themselves to pay millions to bring in some kid with a bad attitude who's got a strong arm, and it's why the New York State got held hostage to the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah.
To basically build them a brand new stadium in a medium-sized town. But even that, whatever the economic draw is for Buffalo, even that was enough. That loss of civic pride and the potential loss of a civic identification was sufficient to get the government and the state legislature to bend over backwards.
But everybody wants to be in that pool, Lou. But I don't have a problem if there's true economic gain from something. and maybe there is, maybe there isn't. They never really, there was a law professor from UCLA on BBM the other day. And, you know, the guy, I don't know if he listens to the show or what, but he says, you know, they said, what do you think about the Bears stadium? He goes, it'll be the same as every other stadium. He said, the team is going to make a bunch of money. The mayor or whoever puts it together is going to get a few kudos. Every one of his buddies is going to get a contract for either building the place or for the cans or for the for a beer stand. They're all going to make money, and the regular population is going to get their ass kicked. It happens every single time. The Bears don't come close to paying for the renovation at at Soldier Field with their rent. Let's say we do that. We put them in Soldier Field 20 years ago. Is it really necessary, Lou, to give them a lease over 20 years that doesn't change? And then when they raise the ticket prices, they're still paying $6.5 million a year? Is that really necessary for them to leave Soldier Field owing $400 million on a place that I'm going to have to eat? Is that really? Can't we make the deal? My criticism here is not with what you're talking about, because I think you're actually right. But I heard some politician from Indiana. It's all about, it's the same subject I have with Trump, the same subject I have with Biden. Don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining. The guy in Indiana said, here's our deal. We just passed something in the state legislature. We're going to build a stadium for the Bears. The Bears are going to rent it. After a period of time, the Bears are going to have an opportunity to buy it. Lou, I don't have any problem with that. Zero. What's missing? Tell me what's missing.
No, I
three numbers.
I think that's...
No, what's number missing? Three numbers.
Okay.
Okay. What's it going to cost to build it? Let's say $4 billion. All right. So what's our interest rate? Make that four numbers. What's our interest rate the state's going to pay? Let's say 6%. All right. So $4 billion, that's $240 million a year in interest, just an interest. Okay. I don't have a problem with that. If the bare lease is going to be $300 million a year, I'm all for it. If the bare lease is going to be $5 million a year, I got a problem. And then what's the price we're going to give it to the Bears? We're going to sell it to the Bears for $1 after 20 years, and we're going to eat the $380 million we still owe on the place? Billion or $3.8 billion? Now I have a problem. If the numbers match, I don't care, but they never do. That's the problem. If the Bears have been paying $10 million in lease, or 10 or 12, or it started at 6 and went up $2 million a year for the last 20 years, and Soldier Field was paid off, and they wanted to go somewhere else, God love you. Go with God's blessing. But that's not what happened.
No, and yes, it's going to move forward. You know it's going to move
forward.
Sure
it is.
And because notwithstanding whatever machinations are going on with respect to pricing and who's going to make money, at the very bottom line is the loss of a huge sports franchise that nobody wants to be associated with.
That's your argument. My argument is, and this is, you see this problem, and I don't know,
my argument is backed up by history, which acknowledges
so
you
mine.
Are exactly right. This goes on over and over and over again. Why does it? It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. It doesn't make economic sense. Why does it happen?
It
happens because of these non-economic factors that drive the consideration here.
I'll tell you why it happens, in my opinion. It has to do with the weakness of the democratic system. The democratic system has a lot of strengths. It also has a lot of weaknesses. And we see the weaknesses of the people that are making the money off this, of which will be the Bears. I guarantee you, the stumble bum in Indiana who's trying to put this thing together at Hammond already has his list of 25 people that are going to make money on this thing. And they're not. It's not you and me. Those people, the people who make the money, okay, whether it's in the courts, whether it's in building roads, whether it's in buying stuff for the military, people make the money can bring more resources to bear to win. For you and I don't like the thing, Lou. I don't like it at all. But it's going to be, if you whittle it down to me, it'll be $100 out of my ass or $200 over the next 10 years, okay? It's not worth it for me to not do what I do for my clients for a day and walk up and down Michigan Avenue with a sandwich sign. Or going on TV or writing articles, letters to the editor saying why it shouldn't happen, why the economics don't work. It's not worth it to me to fight them, but it's worth it to them to fight me. That's the problem. And I don't know how you stop that. You know, it's just like Commonwealth Edison. They put through some ridiculous wage increase. It would take 1,000 of us, Lou, donating money, donating in time to fight this. It'll cost us thousands of dollars a person, not to mention hours, to fight the increase. And if we win, all we do is get our $50 a month back that we shouldn't be paying in the first place. And I don't know how you stop that in a democratic situation. It's almost it's like the old joke. You know, let's have four wolves in one hen voting on who to have for breakfast.
Well, the key, I mean, just as a sort of a general political science perspective, the key to putting a plug on this, in my opinion, is accountability and transparency. And if you can get enough transparency out there, and you can get the information on, hey, look, this looks like a good deal, but it's actually going to cost us, you know, $4 billion over whatever. If you can get the transparency out there, at that point, if people still want to vote for it, you throw your hands up and say, okay,
but you're never going to see that. Let's assume we still have a newspaper. Why doesn't the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Sun-Times, without being for or against anything, why hasn't some schmo written an article that says, here's what it costs to build Soldier Field or remodel it or whatever. Here's the ongoing cost. Here's the debt. Here's how we had to refinance it. And here's how much the Bears have paid in rent. And by the way, here's how much the Bears have made every year. If you put that chart on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, I think you get a tremendously different view of this thing. But I've never seen it. And you'll never see it. Why?
I agree. So that's why you need somebody to put this information out there and just explain it. I mean, we're going through the same thing, not quite the same thing, but we're going through the same thing here in Denver. And the effectively what's happening is that but the Broncos can't move out of state. I mean, theoretically they could, but you know, they don't have a because it's in the middle, Denver sits in the middle of the state. It's not a question of them scooting up the road to Cheyenne, you know, 200 miles away.
Yeah.
They can't do it. So they're going to be in the Denver area for sure. And they're, I mean, for whatever it's worth, and maybe, Tom, maybe it's the result of the ownership. Because the ownership of the Broncos is not a family. It used to be, but it's not a family now. It's a consortium of investors, an investor group. And they're all business people, and they're being, I think, reasonably thoughtful in terms of this is how we're going to do it. This is where the funding is going to come from. This is how much it's going to cost. This is what we're putting in around the stadium. This is, you know, where this is where we're going to buy the land, and this is how much we're funding. This is how much the city's funding. This is how much the state's funding, and it has been. Pretty straightforward, but again, this is I just wonder if a lot of this is driven by the family nature of your ownership.
Lou, I would make you a I'll make you a nice tea bet that the entire amount of lease paid by the Bears in Wrigley Field and Soldier Field, I bet I'm off by a half a year, does not equal their profit in the last year and a half.
I'm sure that's right.
Is that pretty scary or what?
Yeah. Well, it's frightening because, especially for you as an economist, those numbers aren't being driven by the market.
Right.
They're driven by something else. I mean, don't know what that something else is, do we?
I mean, if the governor of Indiana wants to pay for it, or the numbers match, let them go. But some stuff that I part of what I see going on in Washington for the last 25 years, I'm not just pinning it on this particular group, I really wonder, I really thought, Lou, when I was in school, and everybody I knew kind of went to college and was taking economics classes at Western Illinois, where I went, didn't have to go to Notre Dame. And I thought that when I got to this age, the collective stupidity of people in this country would not be what it is. And I cannot believe the stuff people believe now. the idea that, you know, the Fed doesn't even mention money supply. Well, if you'd have told somebody in 1981 that people would never that you couldn't even mention the word on TV. They'd go, "What are you talking about? We've been fighting this battle for 12 years. We finally won when people started to understand that. Now we can't mention it again, right?" It's the collective. Why this has happened? How many stadiums have ever made money? Now, at some level, you know, I'm all with you. Somebody wants to, you know, build a place, and you know, and should the city have a L stop there? Well, hell yeah. I mean, same way if you and I wanted to have a massive, you know, we're gonna build railroad cars. We're gonna hire 2,000 people. Well, do you think maybe we could get a railroad stop near our spot? Sure. I understand that. The city's supposed to respond to things like that. But this other stuff, why can't, if you and I want to build a factory, why can't we get the money rather than the Bears? How many full-time employees in the city of Chicago do the Bears have? Any?
Yeah, good question. I don't know.
I'm thinking no. They're all paid out of Lake Forest.
But again, this goes back to what we just said. These decisions are being made. This is what drives you crazy. These decisions are not being made for economic reasons.
Well, you know what, Lou? I'm kind of misspeaking here. I don't care about that, actually. If everybody in the city knew that it was going to cost them $200 to keep the Bears here, and we voted to pony up the $200, I honestly don't have a problem with it. But to talk about it,
but that's not what happened.
It's not what happened. Day after day after day, and purposely, out of hundreds of people talking about it, nobody comes up with any of the numbers, and people just blow through it like they're not there. First, the population's idiots, and the people doing it knowing, I guess, they're idiots. I don't know. How do you mention this at all without saying, what's the Bears' lease going to be? how do you not know? How do you?
Well, and again, this goes back to the issue of transparency. And at the end of the day, if you haven't, the population apparently tolerates the fact that, hey, we don't care how it all works out, just don't let the team leave.
Well, okay.
And that's what they're...
But if it's real democracy, which we don't have, if they said, okay, on the ballot on March 17th, the city of Chicago is going to embark on contributing $500 per taxpayer for the Bears, and we're going to put it on the ballot, and it wins by a landslide, I got no problem with it, Lou. I got no problem whatsoever. But that's not what happens. Some people make a lot of dough. They don't tell us who those people are. They don't tell us how much it's going to cost us, and they blow it through because of pride in the team we own nothing about, right? I mean, it's just, we don't have a piece of. Now, if Daly, when he did Soldier Field, would have sat down with the Bears and said, now let's have the real negotiation. We now own 25% of the Bears. Then I don't have a problem with that either.
Yeah. Well, okay. So again, this goes back to this emotional blackmail, extortion, whatever you want to call it, that these major sports clubs either believe they have or actually have. Certainly the politicians believe they have it. And so they can come in, and so when if you know, your city leadership or state leadership was to sit down with the Bears and play hardball with the McCaskies and say, listen, we're not going to put a dime down on this. We know what your we got a pretty good idea what your profitability was last year. We're not putting a doggone dime down here. We might give you some tax breaks, but you're going to have to fund this. You're going to finance it. You're going to fund it. Keep us out of it. Go buy your real estate wherever you want. We don't care. We'd love to have you here, you know, but we're not going to do any of this. It would be great, but it's not going to happen because the emotional cost of having that club move out of Chicago and go play somewhere else is huge.
Well, I would not be the one to be the mayor who lost the Bears.
But that's, you know, what I mean.
Remember when the Bears were going to go to the west side near the stadium? How many years ago was that? It was before Soldier Field was renovated.
Okay. I do recall some of this. I wasn't here when Soldier Field was renovated.
They were going to go to the west side near where the stadium was, now where the United Center is, because the area there was pretty much vacant of anything. You know, so you, even though it was in the city, it was, you know, stuff was torn down by the riots and never, you know, whatever. And so there was a massive negotiation. And the negotiation came down to between the Wirtzes and the Halluses, with the city in the middle of it. And the thing broke down because Wirtz's attorneys, who I happen to know, essentially won the day. And you know what the day was, Lou? They wanted the city to condemn Wirtz's parking lots, which are a big source of income for the Hawks and the Bulls. They wanted the city to condemn Wirtz's parking lots and turn them over to the McCaskey parking lots. So we're going to use a condemnation thing to take the apartment building away from Lou and give it to me, which, even with the Supreme Court, is not necessary. And it broke down over that. It had nothing to do with the stadium. It had to do with these, you know, it's like the Cubs. You got to make it easy for us to buy the neighborhood, and we'll put some money in the stadium. Okay, they got their deal, and they can proudly say they paid for the renovations of Wrigley on their own. Still, they ended up with all kinds of property and a song of which you and I could play for. I mean, it was always behind the world, and I don't think this has grown to, and you see it now in Washington, you know, the guy from the Commerce Secretary, the guy with lunch with Epstein. All of a sudden now he just negotiated some huge deal with Cantor Fitzgerald. Guess what? His kids now run Cantor Fitzgerald. Look, to me, this is all wrong, and yet I'm just a voice in the wilderness. I know it. But it's there. It's relentless, and it's getting worse, I think. And a lot of it is lack of education, lack of press telling people, you know, what here is why doesn't somebody put together the numbers for Soldier Field? Why isn't there an editorial someplace? We're not taking any sort of a opinion on this. This is what's happened for the last 20 years, and this is what the new numbers look like. They're going to happen again the next time. If you want to vote for it, vote for it. Knock yourself out. That's all I care about. I'm not trying to dissuade opinions at all. Honestly, I'm not.
But again, it goes back, and I'm not going to take any more of Andrew and Wayne's time. It goes back to this issue of there's a cost associated with that team leaving.
Yep.
That is going to fall right on the heads of the people who can make the decisions, and they don't want to be part of it.
Hey, let me jump on your side of this argument dramatically for a second. I shouldn't have to help you out, by the way. One of my clients, for those that don't know, there's a massive Jewish community in Minnesota that have always been tight with, you probably know a lot of these guys, Lou. They've always been tight with the Vikings and the baseball team. And he said when the mayor let the Minnesota North Stars go to Dallas.
Dallas.
Because the North Stars were trying to hold the city up for something. And the mayor, who was a guy like me, said, no friggin' way. Well, they left the Dallas. Evidently, the number to keep them there, and this is off the top of my head, was, let's say, $10 million, which seems like a lot. Well, they let them go. The investment to bring in the new team was like 10 times that. So on a relative scale, the guy was probably better off getting held up by the North Stars than he was going out and getting a new team. So I guess the argument that I could make on your side, you know, but if... I still think.
Assuming you get a team in there. I
mean, yeah, assuming you get a team in there.
How long did it take Baltimore to replace the Colts? It took them a while.
Well, if the Chicago would have done this 3 years ago, I think you could have offered, let the Bears go to Indiana. You could have offered Jacksonville Soldier Field for $6.5 million a year. Lou, they had blue smoke coming out of their ass getting up here. How do you give somebody Chicago at that lease rate and not somebody be happy?
I know.
And yet now it's all about more. I mean, you and I, we think a lot differently, but we also think a lot alike. If we were making $200 million a year, we wouldn't be throwing bottles at the wall and being all pissed off because it wasn't 201. Yet there are people like that.
No, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
So,
anyway, right, buddy, what's the Stowe story?
It's bad. It's gotten better, but it's bad. It's about 60% of normal. They're making noise now about Denver getting hit with a foot of snow next week. So by the time we get on the air again, I'll be able to report to you.
But there's the ski areas stop snow.
I mean, they're functioning, but it's not great.
All right, bud, take care. Jimmy, we got our guys on?
Yes, we did.
you have me.
We got Wayne.
Me too.
We got Andrew. What's so? I guess you know. I shouldn't be talking so much about sports stadiums, but when it comes to politics, doesn't it seem like it's always the same story?
Yeah, I mean, a very informed discussion, and it's got a certain parallel here in Washington. And when Wayne was up here last week, I pointed to a success story of citizen opposition to one of these boondoggles. And it was basically the hockey and pro basketball teams wanted to move to a suburb. And they had it kind of greased with some top politicians. But the public of both the suburb, Alexandria, and D.C. kind of organized against it and quashed it, much to the billionaire politician angst, let's say.
Well, you know, we're not there, but I bet if you guys probably know somebody, I'd love to get them on. This whole episode of what's going on in Kansas City, dragging them across the river, that has to be even a bigger story than what's going on here. Kansas City's in the current stadium's in Kansas, right? They're trying to move them to Missouri, or is it the other way around?
Other way around.
They're in Missouri, and Kansas wants to get them to across the river? Is that the story? I think it is.
That is correct. They're in Kansas City, Missouri, and now they want to go to Kansas City.
Well, I hate to say this, but a few years ago, when Kansas City, I guess they won the Super Bowl, Donald Trump was president, and he congratulated the great state of Kansas for winning the Super Bowl. So remember how he took his Sharpie and there was a hurricane coming up. It wasn't going anywhere near Alabama, but he took his Sharpie on the weather map and extended it himself to Alabama. Maybe the reason that they're moving over to Kansas now is so he can point to that old quote and say, "See, I was right all along."
Well, I tell you what, never having been there, I think I drove through there once. I couldn't tell you which parts in Missouri and which parts in Kansas City. But so it's not like I'd know. But so what's other than everything, the hell's going on in Washington? What is the guy, the ambassador? Do we know what he was charged with yet? The guy was the ambassador here.
Oh, you're talking about Lord Mandelson?
Yeah,
it's the same. Basically, they brought the same charges on him as they brought on
Prince?
The pedophile formerly known as Prince. What they're hitting them on is the unauthorized disclosure of private sensitive information. They don't say to who, but that's part of the criminal investigation. But Mountbatten Windsor, he was actually an official UK trade envoy who had access to a lot of classified information, and the charge is that he passed a lot of that on to Epstein. Same with Mandelson. He was the business minister of Britain and had similar access to a lot of trade information, same sort of stuff, and he's being looked at for passing the information on to Epstein. I think this is a case of the camel, which is the British law enforcement, getting their nose under the tent, because they need to have something provable and maybe a little less controversial to start looking at the other stuff. And the other stuff is the really bad stuff with the trafficking of children and whatnot.
How would you, Senator Schmo is seen in a picture with, walking into some room with a 16-year-old girl. How would you ever have any idea whether the guy, unless you already knew somehow, which is what you're kind of writing about, right, Wayne? Unless you already knew somehow that information got leaked to Epstein that went to somewhere else, that went to the Mossad, that went to Russia, you must already have some evidence. How would I make the jump from the senator being like a Summers guy that just wanted to find young girls to where he's willing to trade state secrets for it? How would I ever get to there unless I already knew?
Well, Britain has its own version of our National Security Agency, the Signals Intelligence Intercepts of Communications. It's called the GCHQ. It's out in Cheltenham, in the middle of the Cotswold, in England, and they have well, up to this point, they've had access to a lot of the U.S. spy satellite data, but apparently, because of Trump, the U.K. is switching over to using French signal intelligence satellites. So,
really?
But nevertheless, they probably have copies of text messages, phone calls, emails, and all that, those types of communications, not only from Prince Andrew and Mandelson, but also on the other side of those phone calls, Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and possibly people more nefarious than even those two.
Well, do you think they have stuff like trading records where somebody, allegedly Andrew, talked about some company doing something, and the next day people buying options or stock?
Yeah, because and not only do they have GCHQ, they have the Serious Frauds Office in London, which I've investigating a lot of corporate malfeasance, especially having to do with mercenaries. The Serious Frauds Office is, no pun intended, a serious operation. They really know their stuff, and they haven't been compromised, of course, like some of our agencies, notably the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which is now under the control of Scott Bessent. So God knows what's going on there. But it's known as all source intelligence, and that's what the Metropolitan Police in London probably have dossiers on both these two guys and others. I think there's going to probably be other shoes to drop on this criminal investigation.
There's gonna be none to drop here.
So far, we see a lot of resignations in the private sector, but nothing from the Trump administration. I thought it was funny during the State of the Union, Howard Lutnick came strolling down the aisle pretty much by himself. Normally, there's people accompanying these cabinet secretaries, and then he gets to the end of the aisle, and he turns around and he grabs Chief Justice John Roberts on his shoulder, and it looked like Roberts was doing everything possible to try to avoid this encounter. But yeah, no resignations, no firings, I think that's the name of the game with Trump 2.0.
Andrew, where is the situation? There's a guy, a Republican in Congress. Did he just get convicted of something, and they don't want him to resign because the numbers are so
well
close?
He's not convicted. You're talking about a Texas Republican who's actually in a quite contested primary that goes to a vote March 3rd. And it's a huge scandal, and in fact, to amplify a bit about it, it's really horrible. If the charges, it's not criminal charges yet, but the allegations is that a married father of six congressman, of course, his family values, had pressured a staffer who was also married to have an affair, and that she later killed herself out of angst about the situation.
That's pretty serious.
And her husband, or ex-husband, I forget if they got a divorce, but he's pushing it, and he's got access to her cell phone and messages, and the ex-husband, with that destroyed family, he's on the warpath. And So the congressman, I believe his last name is Gonzalez, he doesn't want to resign. Innocent until proven guilty. No criminal charges. But here's the two huge, huge problems for the Speaker of the House and the Republican majority and President Trump. They've, in effect, got a one-seat majority now. And if the guy resigns, it's going to be months before he's replaced. And so they'd be on the cusp of losing their majority if somebody just got into an auto accident or got sick. And so it's also in the middle of the Epstein scandal and the cover-up. And so in normal times, people would say, get this guy out of here. Even if there's no criminal conviction, it's just the worst of the worst. You've got a dead mother here. It's a classic case, you can't frame it any more dramatically, of people saying, yeah, but we don't want to lose our power.
Well, this is nuts and bolts on this. If, and I'm sure as hell I want this to happen, if he is gone and one other person leaves, since was it the Republicans or the Democrats put in a thing you can call for a new speaker at any time, what happens if the Democrats have a one-person majority? The next day, would they call for a new vote?
Well, they should be tried and shot if they and charges of political malfeasance if they didn't do that.
Well, I mean, but didn't when Johnson was put in there, didn't the people that agreed to put him in there say that any one person can call for a new vote or something? Isn't that just...
Yeah, that was courtesy of former Congressman Matt Gaetz, who got that put... It's the vacating the chair. It would only right now... there's several Republicans from districts that were carried by Biden, and a few that were carried by Harris. The deal is, if Gonzalez were to be forced out, or somebody like Massey, the congressman who's working with Ro Khanna on exposing the Epstein stuff, if any of them were to go over to the other side, we'd be looking at Speaker Jeffries. No longer Speaker Johnson, so it is that close.
What happens if it's even, and you get an even vote? Does the current guy stay because he's not voted out, or what? I mean, I don't think anybody.
Can you imagine with it being it's hard to imagine it's this close when you got 435 seats. You know,
how many are vacant? There's several vacant, right?
There's a few still. There's a Andy might know the ones that are still, there's a few still vacant, right?
In various, somebody gets appointed or dies, and they, depending on state law and who's in charge of elections in a state, they can either try to have a quick election to fill a vacancy, or they can stretch it out sometimes for almost a year to keep it vacant if they think the other party is going to win the seat. And all of these games, they're of course anti-democracy when played to the hilt, but they're all coming together like some kind of Shakespearean play now, because this Tom Massey, the Republican from Kentucky, he's been considered a super, super conservative, a libertarian, and it just came out about a week ago how he got so focused on Epstein a year ago, and it was almost by accident. His wife said, why don't you ask a question when you go to this nice dinner with Pam Bondi, and he wasn't a big militant or anything. He just thought, okay, that sounds like a good question to ask at this nice dinner the Attorney General has about what's in these Epstein files. And that leads him down the rabbit hole of being really outraged at what's in these files about trafficking, the elites, and a cover-up. And by the way, just a point of additional information, he's an MIT graduate, which is a little different than people might think of as, you know, Kentucky successful politician. But a lot of this stuff kind of plays into, you know, a kind of unlikely Bulldog Drummond or whatever, Inspector Javert, who's unearthing this worldwide scandal. And the last thing I'll say about this for the moment, Wayne has been writing these columns chronicling how all over the world, in Norway, UK, elsewhere, people are looking at these revelations and saying, get these people out of here. This is
do you believe, no, follow-up question, do you believe, I you can knock me over with a feather, when the guy from the Emirates quit, I thought those guys didn't care about anything like this, and boy, he was out of there fast, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, and he was arrested right afterwards. Now there's photos of him and Trump in more joyous days, celebrating, you know, Trump real estate and, you know, projects in the UAE. And you know, talking about, this is what's wrong with our media. You wouldn't think about this, but the Epstein case is a huge political scandal right now in India, because one of the Indian cabinet members, the Minister of Petroleum, was the former ambassador to the UN in New York, and was a frequent guest of Epstein over at the Epstein mansion, and maintained this very close relationship with Epstein. So he's a member of the Modi government, which is kind of a right-wing Hindu nationalist government, there are now calls from the opposition for him to resign. And instead of, Modi's a lot like Trump. He won't listen to any kind of criticism. So we know about Epstein's relationship with Israel and the Mossad, along with Russia. So amidst all this, Modi has now is now making it the first state visit of an Indian prime minister to Israel, keeping in mind that India's got the second largest Muslim population on the planet. This guy Modi is probably in real trouble. And although he's not directly involved with Epstein, it's his oil minister who is, he's being tainted by the Epstein scandal. And this guy, who was reelected a few times, may be a victim of the scandal anyone else.
Who's got the largest population? Is Pakistan?
Indonesia.
Really?
Yes.
Which is odd, because they're both Asian countries. They're not where we normally associate with, you know, the Middle East.
Right.
Well, we've kind of gone through the various weeks, and you guys have been on, and with some of the stuff Wayne's been doing and what other guys have come up with, is we've kind of gone from this sort of sex sort of thing to international secrets and some stuff, you know, be it military, be it whatever. We got a few minutes before we go to break, but when we do go to break, would you guys put your thinking hats on, and how much of this is economic? I mean, how many, like, real deals was it necessary for Goldman Sachs to be in this group? Was it necessary? Oh. I mean, on an economic basis, if you wanted to know how the hell to money launder, did you have to be at an Epstein party? And plus, you know, I was, you know, talking to Lou, you know, on many levels, but having to do with the whole stadium thing, it, to me, it's a massive microcosm of withholding information, not putting the information out, having somehow getting the press to not put it out, or not having a press, where people don't even know where they have opinions and don't even know what the opinion's all about because they don't even have the numbers in front of them. I guess on this whole thing with, we also have been kind of brainwashed that all the nasty stuff happened on this little island that nobody gives a crap about. You know, it's in the Caribbean. If somebody wanted to fly down there and boink somebody, I guess it's not my business. But I'm going to say, by listening to Wayne and reading some stuff, 90% of this stuff happened at either Manhattan, Ohio, New Mexico, or the place in Florida. I mean,
Epstein had a couple of residences in Paris also, which has caused the French government to restart a criminal investigation of that ring. It was suspended when this guy Jean-Luc Brunel, who was an Epstein associate, he owned a modeling agency and was trafficking women and underage girls. He supposedly committed suicide awaiting trial in 22. So in this case, suicide seems to be a contagion. And the French suspended the investigation. Now they've restarted it. I think they're looking at what Epstein was doing in Paris.
Well, if you were to drop down to even, I'd say this area downtown, is as areas go, is fairly well informed. I'd never be able to collect on this bet, not because you guys don't pay, or would take the other side. I'm going to say if you looked in the midst of most people's minds, when I say most people, not like the three of us, this is not supposed to sound bad. They might have a real job where they're not. Their job is not to look at this stuff. They might have a family. They might have all kinds of stuff that is making their day wish it was 30 hours instead of 24. Say, in most people's minds, this probably is, so what, some pervert got a private island in the middle of nowhere, somebody had the ability to get there, either on his plane or some big, huge yacht they had, and they were messing around with little girls. Why is that my problem? And yet, it's way bigger than that. A lot of it happened here, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it happened, yes, in Paris. I mean, and I don't think that message, just like the Bears' rent being so cheap, is out there. And I guess my question is, why? I mean, why?
Well, I think you put your finger on it a few moments ago when you asked the question, how much of it's economic? And we're now seeing gradually that a huge part of this is big-time financial operations and also political operations with a twist of probably trading and defense secrets and defense companies, and the reason that is not widely known to the man on the street is, well, it's inherently secret, and the people that know, their fallback, the two fallbacks are nothing happened, or okay, there's one pervert who was involved, but he's dead, so let's forget about it. But the larger story that's being unraveled for those who dare look at it is, it is financial, it is espionage, it is national security, and that affects everybody.
What do you say we go to break and we'll expand on this? We come back and we'll maybe zero in on the Cantor Fitzgerald piece. Not because I have anything bad against the company. Poor people all got killed in 9/11. But well, let's talk about that a little bit. SP Futures up 6, NASDAQ Futures up 15. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
We're back.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom, Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 6, the S&P futures up 16. Again, last night was the big night. The big night was NVIDIA earnings. And they came out. They were really good. The stock traded over 90, over traded over 202, I think. Now it's back down to 197. This is not a any kind of a buy or sell recommendation or anything. I just did a little some math for everybody. I now have NVIDIA, is a massive company, growing fast, growing very fast. Is now 16.8 times, the stock is trading 16.8 times revenue. They have, what the hell is the revenue? The revenue per share is $12. Stock's trading 200. So do the math. And I'm not saying, you know, they could double this year. So I'm not saying sell or don't buy or whatever. I'm just look at that number. It's a sobering number. That's all I'm saying. Over in Europe, we got the DAX up 117.5%, FTSE up 20.2%, CAC around up 74.9%. In Asia, Nikkei up 170.3%, Hang Seng down 384. They're going the other way, 1.5%. Shanghai actually back open, up down 50 cents. Let's call that one flat. Nikkei crosses 59,000 for the first time. The central bank picks fuel somebody to do something. Tachaki. Bonds, and absolutely steady. They're down 4.04% 10-year. Actually, they're down a little bit. The Bund, 2.70. We've got oil down $1.50 to under 64 now, 63.96. So oil's telling you whatever's going on with the nuclear talks today, there must have been some kind of a cooling off. Of course, that, you know, goes by the day. Brent a dollar, $29.69.56. Gold, down $33, $51.92. Still way over 5,000. Silver down $3.90. That's a big move. It's $86.99. It's a 4% move. Foreign exchange, dollar, euro's 118, so that's pretty high. The British pound's over 135, 135.4. So the dollar still is on the low end here. Crypto, we had a huge rally yesterday, but today it's down 952, but it's back up to 68,141. A lot of stuff there. Jimmy, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Traffic inbound on the Kennedy is now 23 minutes. From the Jane Byrne, inbound on the Edens is 38 minutes. From 290, inbound on the Eisenhower is 38. And inbound on the Dan Ryan, excuse me, is 33. Weather, Phoenix is currently 61 with a high of 89 degrees. Chicago is 28 with a high of 44. In regards to sports last night, it was the NBA. The Celtics got trounced by the Nuggets 103-84 for the Nuggets over the Celtics. And it is back to you, Chief.
So the NVIDIA was a kind of a nothing. Like I said, it's only up. Wish we'd have done a spread in there. It's only up $1.69. But guys, I guess the question, and the only two people I know that maybe have the ability to answer this, and it's all kind of human. I don't know. It's like human. It's like in Star Wars. You know, when they wanted to go get a guy to to fly them off the planet they were on, they had to go in that crummy bar, right? I mean, you look at Cantor Fitzgerald. Now, those guys are a worldwide investment firm at the top floor of the World Trade Center, which, unfortunately, they're everywhere. You know, they're like a Goldman Sachs. In fact, they zero in on this international stuff probably even as much or more as Goldman Sachs. Now, all of a sudden, and we all kind of know that there's the regular way to send money and there's kind of other ways. There's people that specialize into, other than, you know, having the boobs in the hot tub, Epstein's main talent, for lack of a better term, was the ability to launder money, correct? Whatever that means. Now, if you're in that business, I mean, you guys are in the information business. I'm not going to ask for specifics. I'm going to guess once or twice you had to go to some bar where there were some crummy hookers hanging around where you didn't really want to be there, but you sort of had to be there.
You don't want me to provide a list of those. We don't have enough time.
No, but I'm saying, did this guy from Cantor Fitzgerald feel economically that he had so much stuff is gone? I mean, we'll have some president, we've had a couple lately, pompously get up there and saying we're stopping. Matter of fact, Obama did it too. Russia can't get any money through the international, whatever the international way of cashing checks, this sort of thing. Yet we all know somehow Russia's surviving. Same thing with Iran. Somehow people are getting money to Iran. So is it almost necessary, I'll use that term loosely, for a Cantor Fitzgerald to at least hang out with somebody by Epstein just because of all the other creatures that are there and the other ways of doing what they're not supposed to be doing? I mean, you almost have to sit down with the dogs with fleas once in a while to find out what they're doing. I hope the answer is not yes, but I have a feeling it is.
I think it's been that way for a long, long time. Remember that there were a lot of companies on Wall Street that were doing business with Nazi Germany right up to December 7th, 1941. As you say, they're interested in money. They're not interested in some cases, international law or anti-trafficking laws or sanctions or anything like that. They're out to make money, and you know, these other matters are just mere road bumps, impediments. But you can run over an impediment, and I think they do a lot of that.
Well, I mean, just in a general term, say the three of us had some big business. God knows what we're. You know, we're doing, let's say Lou had a long story a few months ago about the Russian trains. You know, we're talking about in the middle of nowhere, some of these trains are conking out because they couldn't get roller bearings. And for people who don't know, Timken has made roller bearings forever. So if your roller bearings go and your car stops, unless you can find a way to get it to another track, your whole train's pretty much skunked. Now, if somebody... You know, if we were people who all of a sudden had an old bunch of roller bearings and somebody from Russia wanted to buy them, and we could find a way to ship them, which I bet we could, and we go to Cantor or we go to Goldman Sachs, who normally we do our business with, and say somehow or another, this guy in Russia owes me, you know, $10 million. I got to get it here. I don't know that they would legitimately do that in their offices, but somehow, someplace, I have a feeling you can get that money if you know the right people.
I investigated the the Madoff situation. You know, Madoff had a public trading firm, Madoff Securities. He also had a back room, and I heard this from a guy who was actually his chief assistant, and he said, yeah, in the back room, Bernie Madoff would come in and say, hey guys, let's roll the accounts in the Caymans. Let's roll the accounts in Belize. This was all the off the books operations that Madoff was involved with. So, you know, Madoff Securities. The guy helped start the the Nasdaq. So he was an institution.
He
on
was
Wall
he
Street.
Was appointed. Don't get me started because I know an awful lot about. I know an awful lot about Bernie Madoff because I was on the board of the CBOE.
Right.
And Bernie did all his... He was the guy who invented payment for order flow, by the way. I don't know if you knew that or not. And he did this by being a member of the Cincinnati Stock Exchange. And the CBOE bought the Cincinnati Stock Exchange. And even though there still was a building in Cincinnati, the Cincinnati Stock Exchange was essentially a computer in the basement of the CBOE. And they bought up, I don't know, say there were 200 seats. The CBOE owned like 190. But there's a little known favorite college rule that if an exchange buys another exchange, no matter how many seats they only get one vote. So Bernie owned like five seats. So Bernie was able to do business on the Cincinnati Stock Exchange and did the payment for order flow piece. And somewhere along the line, since he was considered this electronic genius, the NASD appointed him to the electronics training like task force. The guy was a crook. Yet he wasn't head of the NASDAQ. He was head of, I don't know, Andrew, what was it? He was something about the electronic advancements of the NASDAQ or something. He was head of that group that did all the electrification of the NASDAQ or something. And brought the appointment for order flow right with him. But I guess does it get to the point where how does the government not know about this? Or is CIA totally tied into Goldman Sachs and Cantor Fitzgerald? And here we are years later, the guy's in Epstein Island stuff. Now, I'm not accusing him, with him and his kids sitting there running in the back room for 20 minutes saying he went to the men's room and taking care of some 15-year-old. I don't think that's true, and I would never say that. Yet, here it is, years later, the guy's the Commerce Secretary negotiating some foreign deal with Cantor, and now his kids are in are these people absolutely totally amoral crooks, or what are they? You guys know them better than me.
Well, while we were talking to the Wikipedia to get some numbers on Cantor Fitzgerald. So it's got 1,600 employees, 12,000 employees with some affiliates that they're associated with, but they lost 658 employees during the September 11 attacks.
And that was the top shelf of their guys.
Yeah, they were at the top floors.
No, I mean, they were the top people. That was their main office.
Yeah. So we're talking about a company that's both very large and has an unprecedented tragedy. And Howard Lutnick, our Commerce Secretary, was named President and CEO in 1991. So how long ago is that he's been operating at the highest levels? And it's no wonder that he waltzes down the aisle at Congress and slaps John Roberts, the Chief Justice, on the shoulder like they're pals, despite what's come out. On the lying about his relations with Epstein. And I think this leads to a larger and very important issue in Washington and elsewhere. And I might even bring in hockey on this, in keeping where Stacks and Jacks are, is many of these relationships are both social and commercial. And so for people involved, such as either a men's or women's Olympic champion hockey team, to what extent do they say, boy, I'd like to be at the White House. I'd like to meet all these people. And then a little birdie goes off in some of their minds saying, gee, look at these scandals. And either do they say, well, I don't care, this is my chance to be at the White House or make some money or get endorsements for my career, whether it's in sports or finance. And these are very tough issues that a lot of people are grappling with And ultimately, all of us in the public have to say, well, we may not be powerful, we may not be invited to the White House, but do we want our heroes just backslapping with the Epstein and his friends?
Well, man, it's certainly a moral issue, and I go round and round with this with Carl, in that and he's kind of a law and order sort of dude, and I don't know that. I think we've kind of lost that. I mean, we're all sort of the same age, and it's something that we grew up with, and we think it's still sort of here. I don't know that an awful lot of people now are. If you're not cheating, you're not trying. I mean, I certainly see it in traffic. I see it in police never pull anybody over. They see somebody go right through a stop sign right in front of them. The thought of pulling them over wouldn't. I mean, something dramatically has changed gradually, and I don't know that if I was a cop tomorrow and started pulling people over, they wouldn't look at me and say, what are you doing?
Well, let's go to the world stage here. I hope all of our listeners have had a chance to look at the video montage of our FBI director palling around, swigging booze, acting like he's part of the gold medal hockey team in Italy. And I just had a chance to look at it recently.
Was he buying, or was they buying for him?
Oh, you've not seen it?
No, I haven't heard about him. I'm trying to find it today.
No, you got to look at this stuff, because he's in a hockey jersey. He's in the locker room. He's swigging booze. He's like John Belushi at the frat house at the last stages.
Not only house. Yeah. Not only that, but after the locker room incident, he went with the hockey players to a Milan strip club where they sang the national anthem. I mean, you
can't make this up.
No.
I mean, even Wayne and I were talking about it privately, which we'll share. We say, even Hoover, and we know he had a secret life, but even Hoover kept some kind of dignity in public.
Well, I knew most of the hockey players that were on a team in Notre Dame and all from Canada. Those guys all had a zest for living. So when the hockey players won, the first thing that crossed my mind, this is going to be a wild time in Milan tonight.
Well, but here's let me connect a dot here, because among the scandal, supposedly there should be a serious point, not just mocking the people. He's the FBI director. He's supposed to be investigating crime and law and order. And how in the world does he get away with neglecting his duties by a junket like this in a public display? And I'll just offer a quick thought. It's a theory. It's not fact. But maybe he knows so much about the Epstein files, among other things, that he's invulnerable, because people would not want to get rid of him and send him back to being a podcaster yakking about what's in the Epstein files. He's better off kept there as part of a cover-up, and let him go and get drunk and cart his girlfriend around all over the world on an FBI airplane.
Well, he certainly has a different personality than the guy to get rid of, right?
Yeah, that's
well,
for sure.
Also,
can you imagine Merrick Garland at a strip club? No.
What about, who's the guy before him? Comey, or the guy that went to
Comey. Yeah, they used to call Comey a Boy Scout because he was apparently didn't use foul language and didn't drink and all that kind of stuff.
Well, we'll shift gears a little bit, because we've talked really about the stadium stuff, about this stuff, and how people are kind of led off into directions. All this stuff happened on the island. Well, no, it didn't. There were like five locations, right? But somehow or another, my mother used to use the term brainwashed, and I've been doing a little bit of stuff, and tomorrow morning, if one of you guys has any any knowledge like you always seem to do. First hour, Kevin won't be able to be here, but John Lee's going to be on, and I asked maybe Larissa, but I want to go through some of this stuff, and you know, I don't want to make a major political fight out of it, but the idea that everybody who's here is a that isn't a citizen. Now I'll use the term, the idiots in Washington want to make banks go through everybody's records now and find out if somebody's a citizen. You know what? I know Polish cleaning ladies have been here for 40 years and aren't citizens. We're going to throw them out now, too? They're the enemy? I mean, come on. I can't go. But so the idea that Social Security, that these people are essentially takers, not givers. I just went through some of the history of Social Security, and I talked to a few people. And the idea that what most of the society doesn't realize, because I don't know, they believe this buffoon in the White House, most people who are here that are not citizens have been paying Social Security their whole life, and they're never going to get a benefit. Yet how did the Doge people go in there and uncover some crap about a number that was 120 years old and everybody's stealing from? How did they not get the part where people are paying in and are never getting any money out?
First of all, when they estimated that there's all these people on the rolls, they were so uninformed. A lot of them were kids in their 20s who worked on the campaign, and they're deputized to help run the country, and they didn't realize that these are dead people, the people that they were talking about, who are not getting benefits.
Yeah.
And so they're just looking at the records without understanding a key part, that they're dead people who are not getting money.
When I first came down here, and I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know, but yeah. I became friends, we're talking the 80s. I became friends with people that owned restaurants down here. There were a few, it was a Greek group that owned all these places. And actually, there were two different Greek groups, but I knew these people, and they would tell me that some of the people that worked in the kitchen, they knew they were illegal. I mean, it was a lot of that going on in the 80s. And they all had Social Security cards that were essentially fake numbers. And we have a listener to the show that, after I talked about it the other day, called me up and said, my parents owned a restaurant. This absolutely went on. You knew they were fake numbers, or you had a suspicion. You sent in, when the guy got his check, you sent the money to the government. The money never came back. You never got a phone call saying, hey, Wayne of Wayne's restaurant, you sent me $50 for a Social Security number XXXX. There is no XXXX. You would never get that call. The money is just there. And if you came here, there's actually such a thing, guys, that is like if you got a 6-month visa, I think you get a Social Security card that essentially is is temporary of some kind. I don't know how that works. That's what we're trying to find out tomorrow. But if you just...
I think you're talking about a J visa, which is temporary workers.
So like Elon Musk, when he came here on a student visa, I'll bet somewhere along the line he got one of those. Well, he never left. And it took years before he became a citizen, right? I don't know.
He lied about his status on his...
But I'm saying, but in the interim, the guy had a job. He was getting paid. Well, the money is still going, I'm sure, on the same number to the Social Security Administration. Nobody ever said, hey, wait a minute, this guy Musk, he's supposed to be out of here by now. Let's call up and say, either get the hell out or whatever. If he didn't become... So there are people, and again, I have a buddy I know, or an acquaintance, I'd say. He's an accountant. He does work for this construction firm. And he goes, there's a guy there who's retiring at age like 70. The guy's been here 30 years. He's Hispanic. He came in here on a work visa, got his Social Security card or whatever it was. He never left. Has been paying in all those years. He's not going to...
And remember, Melania came in on an Einstein visa because she was, she had talents that apparently we needed.
Well, I mean, but the mantra is, the brainwash is, somehow they're taking advantage of us. I think it's the other way around, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the other point... Yeah. Well, Andrew sent a letter out yesterday when we were talking about this, that people more talk about, going to the schools and going to the other stuff. Well, guess what? Schools are funded by property and sales taxes, right? Well, these people don't pay property and sales taxes? I think they do. How the hell do you live?
Well, there's such an emotional component to these debates about this. And so I say facetiously, but partly seriously, the big question to at least some people as part of this debate is, are they eating the dogs? Are they eating the cats of the people who live here? to quote that famous campaign argument. And so if it goes beyond the dollars and cents of Social Security contributions to powerful emotional tendencies one way or another, or arguments.
Well, without a doubt. But I mean, I'm just saying, every time that you hear these are my you guys, you especially, Andrew, when you hear these kind of seemingly diverse opinions on things, I suspect you drop back to your law education and you say, okay, what's really going on here? Well, I do the same thing on the economic side. Okay, these guys are taking money from us. Right. Well, in this particular area, it seems like they're not. It seems like it's the other way around. You know, I don't know. You know, people will say, look at the medical care they get. I don't know. I've ever seen a non-documented Hispanic guy going to get a knee or hip replaced at age 65 on us. Have you? I never have.
Well, here's where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people, a lot of voters. And I'll say this, even though the point of my what I'm about to say cuts against us, my view that this is grossly excessive, abusive immigration enforcement. But where a lot of people run into this is at hospital emergency rooms, which because a lot of the immigrants, undocumented migrants are poor, they're not going on the whole to Medicare-enabled private physicians, certainly not specialists. But when things get desperate, they're going to hospital emergency rooms at city hospitals where they more or less have to take them when they're in dire straits. And for a lot of native-born people who come into an emergency room and they see a very large proportion of, in some city hospitals particularly, of the people there in the waiting room are of foreign origin, that's where the emotions and also self-preservation and voting behavior pop up.
Well, in Chicago, it's almost...
I've seen it at emergency rooms.
Well, in Chicago, it's absolutely happening, but now it's people that aren't on Medicaid, they aren't on anything. And matter of fact, I haven't seen him in a while because he had cancer, but one of the guys he's been a carpenter, and I don't know that he's not 65 yet, but now he can't be a carpenter because he's sick. He's had all his chemo and stuff at County Hospital. There's something you can actually, is it called the County Plan or something? I should know. I should find out about this before I talk about it. You can actually sign up and say, I don't have any insurance now, whether you're on Medicaid or whatever, but I'm only going to come to County and they're going to take care of it. I'm sure you got to wait and stuff, but the guy's had, you know, he's still alive, but I don't know if the chemo is helping him or not. I'm making the assumption that it is, and he goes to County.
And, yeah, here in Florida, we have Hillsborough County has its own Medicaid program. So you're right. Yeah, it is at the county level.
Well, here's two other things that are going to happen. They're already happening, but it's going to get probably significantly worse. It'd be interesting to see to what extent people know about it before the midterms. But the New York Times has a story this morning that deductibles under the Affordable Care Act may be raising over the next year to something like $30,000.
Why not make it 100? The people we're talking about don't have anything.
Yeah, right. But what this means, and then there's a parallel development that's going to particularly hurt rural hospitals with a lack of funding. And of course, these are primarily Trump voters, but these hospitals are just increasingly not able to make the dollars work in closing. And so just like you have news deserts where there's no newspaper in many parts of the country, you're going to have hospital deserts where there's no hospital.
Well, Andrew, we'll run over a couple minutes because we started a couple minutes late, but it seems to me, and this is a kind of a brutally simple look at this stuff. Somehow or another, we have people that got control of the medical community that are raping the hell out of everybody money-wise. I mean, we're talking chemotherapy in India is a 500 to 2,000. Here it's 15,000 to 50. Okay, that's quite a difference. The point is, we collectively can't afford it. Now, you can go one of two ways. You can be like the Democrats, who can be dumb as rocks, say we're still going to keep paying for all this. We're not going to try and do anything to the medical community and say, no, you don't get to charge 20 grand for an emergency room visit when you put, you know, five stitches into somebody because he got cut playing softball. 20 is probably an exaggeration, but it's maybe not so far an exaggeration. We're just going to keep somehow paying for it even though we're broke. Well, that's pretty ignorant. So on the Republican side is, we don't like these people anyway. Why don't we just stop paying? If they all die and we don't know them, I guess it's okay. Well, you know, and that's probably a little harsh too. But you know what? Those two approaches aren't that far off. Now, the answer obviously is in the middle. Let's fix the place. Let's make, you know, the 10 stitches 500 bucks like it ought to be, and not, you know, not 10 grand. But neither side seems willing to go anywhere near the fix. They just stay on the one side. Either let them die or throw money at everybody, but we don't have it. What am I wrong
exactly.
here?
Exactly. And on the Democratic side, I think it's important to say there's really two sides there on this issue, and not to oversimplify, but you have the so-called progressive, so-called Medicare for All, Bernie Sanders faction, and they look on themselves as the big reformers, as opposed to more centrists, where I'd probably put you on this issue, and myself, and probably Wayne. But here's the big lie on the Bernie Sanders side, the progressive side. They call it Medicare for All. That's a bumper sticker slogan. It's not Medicare for All, really. It's single payer. And a lot of people are not going to support it because they have private plans that they like. And so part of the logjam on reform is you have all these so-called progressive Democrats who call themselves reformers who are not thinking it through about the dollars and cents and what's really involved politically and financially, and they're just going with a bumper sticker slogan, are you for Medicare for All?
Does Bernie own a calculator?
Well, he's
so old-fashioned, he still uses a pencil and paper.
This is, to me, guys, and then we got a dash. To me, you know, my training, it is so simple. If you've got a prescription drug that costs 10 cents to make and you let somebody charge 10 bucks and you got to take it twice a day or whatever it is, I don't care who you find to pay for it, whether it's other people, whether it's insurance, whether it's government, whether it's the guy next door. You can shove this silly putty all around you want. Simple fact is, you can't do it. Nobody can afford it. I mean, you can push it somewhere for a while, push it someplace else for a while. The fact is, you can't let somebody charge 10 bucks for something that costs a dime. Where am I wrong?
I think you're totally right. But the people that are profiting, they're making massive campaign donations. And so what it gets down to is this Citizens United Supreme Court decision that allows these people making hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes personally, to influence the elections and everything else as part of what should be a reform infrastructure.
Well, let's talk next week. Again, if one of you guys can pile on tomorrow morning, I'd love it, but I didn't ask in advance. But the somehow or another, if you go too far, I mean, I look at the Trump presidency, and I don't like him personally, I never did, as somewhat, actually, it's your buddy Newt Gingrich actually said it about his, I say your buddy, you've been known the guy forever, said the Trump presidency is a total follow-up to the Obama presidency. People are getting more and more nervous about the big money influence and what's going on in Washington. So they elected Obama, who was pretty much an outsider. They thought he might be able to rattle the cage a little bit. He came in and he got totally co-opted. I didn't vote for him a second term. Now, that didn't work, so we're going to bring some, you know, I'll use the term, whatever you want to call it, rabble-rouser sort of guy in here, hoping he could do it too. And it turns out he's dropped into being the most corrupt guy on earth and all he wants is money for him and his family, in my opinion, and has no concept of the job. Well, I'm probably a little too harsh there, and I know people like it.
No, I think you're too easy on him.
Well, okay, but I'm saying, but Gingrich says the guy's there for a reason, is because people are so disgusted with the old guard that first they tried somebody like Obama, new and fresh, hoping he'd be a John Kennedy, and he wasn't. And now this guy, hoping he'd be something, and he's not. So where are we next? Running down the street like the one guy shooting the guy from the drug company? Hopefully we don't go there. I mean, what's the next step here?
To be continued.
Yeah, guys, you take care of yourself. Wayne, your buddy with you in Washington still?
No, I'm back down here in Florida. We had a busy week last week.
Do you fly or do you take the old 75 Toyota?
I actually took Amtrak up, but I couldn't do it on the way. I flew back.
That's the one where you put the car on it, right?
I didn't do the car. I just got a regular seat and made an investment in a major investment in a $3 pillow, which really helped.
By the way, he found that the train, if it continues on to Washington, guess where it goes? Chicago.
Really?
Absolutely. Had I not gotten off, I would have been downtown Chicago.
Well, were you on a superliner or were you on the single level?
Single.
Why didn't you get the first class sleeper? You're a first class kind of guy.
I'm claustrophobic, and I don't know if you've ever seen those compartments on those trains, but they're very, very small. And
well, the ones
that bring back memories of the Three Stooges and Laurel and Hardy doesn't want to participate.
Actually, if you get the first class one on the superliner, it's pretty big.
Yeah, I saw pictures of that. They're a little bit pricey.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But that includes the food, so there you go.
Oh, that's true.
He's holding out for a Pullman ride.
next week we'll talk about there's a special on History Channel on the Pullman Porters. It's pretty educational. It's pretty good. Anyway, guys, thank you. SP Futures up 5, NASDAQ Futures up 1. Big news, NVIDIA's up $1.40. I guess we should have done a spread there. We didn't. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. Good job, Jimmy.
Really, that's all, folks.